So I'm going to be talking about the violence against women in the military. This slideshow, including a longer version with more data, are on my website, which is publichealthandsocialjustice.org. I'll show the website at the end of this. There's an entire page on War and Peace with a lot of open access PowerPoints, and there's also a link to the article that I published on violence against women in the military there, so you don't need to take any notes. And this is all open access, so feel free to use it for your own purposes with appropriate citation. We'll first talk about some definitions of violence, a little bit about the history, data, some characteristics of abuse victims and perpetrators, the consequences of abuse, including PTSD, some recent developments, my advice for female armed services members going off to battle, and how we can reduce violence against women in the military. So there are basically two types of violence against women. The first is direct violence, which is physical, sexual, or emotional violence. And this has a global health burden, which is comparable to that of HIV, tuberculosis, and cardiovascular disease. This is primarily what we'll be focusing on here. However, it's important to remember that there's also institutionalized violence against women, which is the social, the legal, the educational, and the political marginalization that takes place against women, both in the United States and worldwide. There's also a link to an article on rape as a war crime on that page, so I'm going to quickly gloss over that topic. This is unfortunately common, goes back to centuries ago, but at least within the 20th century, the comfort women in World War II Japan, the rapes that occurred in the Sudan, and they're still occurring, and Rwanda and Bosnia. Much of this is related to notions of war and militarism and excessive masculinity. And since 1945, there have been over 300 rapes of Japanese citizens committed by U.S. personnel. And this has a very adverse effect on our military agreements with the Japanese and on support for the Japanese of having U.S. troops stationed there. Today, there are more than 210,000 women on active U.S. military duty, and 1.8 million female veterans out of a total veteran population of 23 million. There are almost 60,000 female troops deployed in Afghanistan and Iraq, and one out of seven U.S. military personnel in Iraq is female. If you look at victims of violence against women in the military, among active duty troops, there are more victims in the Army than in the Navy, or I'm sorry, Army than the Marines, Navy, with Air Force the lowest. The other victims, of course, are the female civilian spouses of active duty personnel. Now, much of the public dialogue surrounding violence against women in the military began with the Tailhook Convention, proceeding through the Aberdeen Proving Ground sexual assaults, and then, more recently, homicides and suicides among returning vets. Between 1997 and 2001, there were more than 10,000 cases of spouse abuse per year in the armed forces and 14 homicides, but this is likely a very large underestimate because girlfriends were not counted and there is a lot of underreporting, and we'll come to that later. You'll see when I give this presentation, there are a lot of data which may seem somewhat conflicting, and that's because, in fact, the data are conflicting. The longer version of the slideshow on the website has many more slides that show various percentage of who's been abused among active duty members, vets, et cetera. Between 1995 and 2004, there were 218 domestic murders in the U.S. military. And from 2007 to 2010, there was an 18% increase in alleged sexual assaults committed by U.S. service members. However, again, there's a lot of underreporting. The Pentagon acknowledges that at least 80% of rapes are never reported. And it's important to note, in terms of families, that child maltreatment is more common during deployments, which suggests that victims have themselves heaped upon them already with these stressors that they face, become perpetrators. Let's look at violence and sexual assault among active duty soldiers and vets. So there are multiple studies, as I mentioned, and first we'll look at active duty military. The abuse rates range from 20 to 35%, depending on the study, and the sexual assault rates from 17 to 33%. Among female veterans, abuse rates range from 24 to 70%, and sexual assault rates from 20 to 42%. If you look at veterans who report a history of sexual harassment in the military, 90% of those under age 50 have reported such events occurring versus only 35% of those over age 50, which probably relates to cultural mores and definitions regarding what sexual harassment is, since it was not well defined in this study. What about female perpetrators of violence? Well, female on male violence is much more common in the military than among civilians, with levels of moderate aggression 13% versus 10%, and severe aggression 4.4% versus 2%. Maybe saying much more is a little of an exaggeration. It's also important to note that LGBT violence is underreported, and this is in part due to provider unawareness and, of course, the don't ask, don't tell policy. And I was able to find one study that, in fact, showed higher percentages of aggression among female active duty military than among male active duty military. And I'm not quite sure what to make of that study. Now, all abusers and abuse victims are, of course, different, but there are some common characteristics that we see in victims of domestic violence, both military victims and non-military victims. And these include things like low self-esteem, poor financial resources, overwhelming sense of guilt, few job skills, self-blame, less education, denial, few friends, more traditional attitudes towards women's roles in the home, a history of childhood abuse, and victims are more likely themselves to have children. Abusers share at least some of these characteristics, such as low self-esteem, dependency, jealousy, poor communication skills, and tend to be unemployed or underemployed more than an age-matched population. Levels of abuse of alcohol and other drugs are high. Many have witnessed or experienced abuse as children themselves. And if they are immigrants, they are more likely to have been victims of political violence. They are also more likely to abuse their own children. Now, military families, as we've already heard today, face unique stressors which increase the risk of family violence. And these include frequent relocations, long tours of duty, frequent family separations, and dangerous work assignments. Let's talk for a moment now about combat stress and PTSD, because both of these increase the likelihood of males perpetrating abuse. Veterans with combat exposure and PTSD have more marital problems, and 1/3 of male veterans with PTSD engage in partner violence. This is a rate 2 to 3 times higher than that for non-PTSD-affected veterans and non-PTSD-affected civilians. What happens to the victims of such violence? These victims are more likely to report chronic health problems, especially gynecological problems, lower health-rated quality of life, higher rates of prescription medication use for emotional problems. They're more likely to fail to complete college. They have annual incomes that are less than $25,000 more frequently. They have 3 times higher rates of depression and 2 times higher rates of alcohol abuse. Among victims, a history of childhood violence and post-military violence is more common, and there are also higher levels of secondary victimization, things like feelings of guilt, depression, anxiety, distrust of others, and a reluctance to seek further help. Well, what about PTSD being caused by sexual assault? The risk of PTSD after sexual assault is similar in both female and male veterans to that following high levels of combat exposure. And female veterans who had suffered sexual assault while in the military were 9 times more likely to have PTSD than those who were not victims of sexual assault and who did not experience high levels of combat-related violence. If you look at PTSD patients, let's look at males first, 6.5% of combat veterans and 16.5% of non-combat veterans reported in-service or post-service sexual assault. I think this is somewhat interesting that the non-combat veterans had higher rates. And if you look at females, 69% of combat veterans, and again, higher rates, 87% of non-combat veterans reported in-service or post-service sexual assault. The two most potent predictors of PTSD for women in the military are combat and sexual assault. Now, I mentioned that underreporting was common, and why is that? There are many reasons. The first is concern about husbands' prospects for continued service and promotion, a perceived and in many cases real lack of confidentiality and privacy, limited victim services, a fear of retaliation and damage to their own careers, or being portrayed as disloyal. Those who do not, or those who do report are in fact often punished, intimidated, or ostracized. Perpetrators of the most vicious crimes are often transferred to another base or offered marriage counseling and anger management classes in lieu of more severe punishment. So knowing this and being aware of this culture, of course, makes women less likely to report. Well, it's interesting. 48% of female active duty military think abuse should be reported to the commanding officer. That's 73% of active duty military versus 43% of female civilians think mandatory reporting increases a woman's risk of further abuse. And 82% of active duty military think that routine screening makes women less likely to disclose their abuse to a healthcare provider. As I mentioned, prosecution and punishment are rare, and promotion is not uncommon for perpetrators. Since 1992, nearly 5,000 accused sex offenders in the Army, according to the Army's own data, including rapists, have avoided prosecution and the possibility of prison time. And between 1988 and 1993, 80% of abusers who left the military received honorable discharges. And of those who remained in the military, 54% were promoted, compared with 65% of the overall military population. What about Iraq and Afghanistan? One out of seven female veterans of these conflicts who are seeking medical care at VAs have suffered sexual trauma. And today, a deployed female soldier is more likely to be raped by a fellow soldier than killed by enemy fire. Many victims of sexual assault and rape in Iraq and Afghanistan have not received basic medical care, such as emergency contraception, rape evidence kits, testing for STDs, prophylactic treatment and testing for HIV, or rape crisis counseling. Again, prosecution of crimes is often delayed indefinitely, and many service women continue to serve in the same units with their assailants. We're all, of course, also aware of disturbing reports of sexual abuse and humiliation at Abu Ghraib, as well as at Guantanamo, and the case of the five American soldiers who allegedly raped and murdered a young Iraqi woman, burned her body, and killed three members of her family in their home. What about recent developments? We're looking at the last 10 or 11 years. In 1999, the VA mandated that all veterans, male and female, be screened for military sexual trauma, but compliance is still low, and a Department of Defense policy review noted major problems in implementing this policy. In 2005, Congress established the Sexual Assault Prevention and Response Office within the Department of Defense. Yet in 2008, Congress asked the director to testify, and the director was ordered by his DOD supervisors not to testify before Congress regarding problems with this office. Today, the DOD requires healthcare provider training on domestic violence for all healthcare providers and has a domestic violence advocates program as well as family support programs in place, but utilization is still low. It bars civilian perpetrators from military bases, and the military police, fortunately, have started to work more with local law enforcement to implement this policy. In terms of victim assistance, the U.S. Army's Transitional Compensation Program provides financial and other benefits to the families of service members discharged for including victim assistance and offender rehabilitation. The VA now provides lifetime sexual assault victims counseling to all military veterans after one leaves the service. And most counseled patients are male, which is not surprising because even though they suffer lower rates of sexual assault, they make up a large majority of those who seek care through the VA. In terms of laws related to this, there is a bill which is currently in House and Senate subcommittee called the Military Domestic Violence and Sexual Response Act. And what this would do is it would reduce sexual assault and domestic violence involving members of the armed forces and their family and partners through enhanced programs of prevention and deterrence, as well as victim services, and in strengthened provisions for prosecution of assailants. Well, here's my advice for female armed services members. Women who are on the front lines, who risk capture and being held as a prisoner of war, which in turn will even put them at higher risk for sexual assault, should strongly consider commencing birth control pre-deployment with either an IUD or birth control implant. Victims should report abuse and consider contacting local domestic violence organizations or the Miles Foundation, which is an advocacy group for military victims of domestic violence. So how do we reduce violence against women in the military? The first would be a change in the sexist ideologies and practices that are long associated with militarism and war. Secondly, improvements in victim services, including enhanced confidentiality. Third, appointment of a central authority within the Department of Defense to investigate and prosecute violent crimes. And then enhanced curricular offerings to teach trainees and practicing clinicians how to recognize and manage the sequela of domestic violence. We need increased funding of shelters, laws to decrease the easy availability of firearms, more funding for research, treatment, and prevention, and changes in law and policy to protect victims and to improve the status of women. There are some international vehicles to decrease violence against women, including CEDAW, the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, UN Security Council Resolution 1325, which mandates protection and respect for human rights of women and girls, and calls on parties of armed conflict to take specific measures to recognize those human rights, and the International Criminal Court, which codifies accountability for gender-based crimes against women during military conflict by defining sexual and gender violence of all types as war crimes. Unfortunately, the U.S. has not ratified CEDAW, signed 1325, nor signed on to the International Criminal Court. So I believe that the U.S. should show its commitment to improving women's rights worldwide by taking action on these issues. The men and women who risk their lives in service to the ideals for which the United States ideally stands deserve no less. So this is the website where you can find the slideshow and others. That's my contact information. I am happy if there is time to answer some questions now, and then, as I noted, I'll be over in 601. Do we have time for questions?
Yeah.
Okay.
Any questions?
I know that women in the military are not able to, because of the prohibitions in federal emergencies, to fight for paper and abortion. Does that extend to emergency contraception?
I can't remember what the current policy is, but I can refer you. Do you know? Okay, that's great. I can tell you that it's somewhere in my brain, because on the website there's a women's health page that discusses obstacles to EC and abortion that specifically has two or three slides relating to it, and I updated it 2 weeks ago. And I'm sorry, I just can't remember the answer, but thankfully Steve did. Yes, ma'am. Yeah, this is not my research. This is just something that interested me and I wrote a paper on. So I should make that clear. I'm not an expert in this area. Yeah, I couldn't find any publications addressing that, but I can tell you that.
To repeat the question.
I'm sorry. The question was, what is the role of traumatic brain injury in perpetration of violence by military, given the tremendous rise in total brain injury, traumatic brain injury, rather, because of improvised explosive devices, et cetera, in Iraq and Afghanistan. I haven't seen any papers specifically looking at the role of traumatic brain injury and perpetration of violence, but I can tell you, just as a physician, that much traumatic brain injury involves damage to the frontal lobe, and with release of the executive function of the frontal lobe, there's more of that midbrain, hindbrain tendency toward violence that all humans genetically have, and therefore among patients you certainly see more aggression when they're in the hospital, and higher levels of aggression overall, and my guess is that probably translates into higher levels of perpetration of interpersonal violence. Yes, sir. No, I'm not aware of that, and I welcome your addressing that if you know more about that or if anyone else does.
Could you repeat the question?
You were asking about the DOD's policies, a certain number, and I'm sorry, could you just say them loudly? Yeah, and I know nothing about those policies. Anyone else? Yes, ma'am. Well, most of the data shows it's an increasing situation due to the stresses of wartime, with lower levels of interpersonal violence during peacetime. And the more wars we're involved in, the higher levels, the greater the numbers of deployments. In terms of looking at the history of this, I'd refer you to the article and slideshow on the website that look at rape as a war crime that goes back to biblical times. And that has a lot of references that relate to interpersonal violence over the centuries and millennia. So I don't want to take up the next speaker's time, but thank you.
Thank you very much.